Side 7, An Agent in Place by Robert Little, continuing on page 244. The maitre d' checked a notebook, found Custer's name. "Table for two," he noted. "Follow me." Clutching the paper bag with the 3 bottles of Georgian wine, the restaurant did not have a liquor license and encouraged clients to bring their own alcohol. Manny beckoned Bassett, and the 2 of them set off after the maitre d' toward a table in the far corner of the private restaurant. Depositing 2 of the wine bottles on the floor under his seat and the 3rd on the table, Manny ordered up a small feast and had the waiter uncork the 1st of the 3 bottles. He waved him away and filled the wine glasses himself. "To no hard feelings," he said, raising his glass. "To no hard feelings," Ben agreed. They clicked glasses and drank their wine. "I'm glad you accepted my invitation," Manny commented conversationally. "I treated you pretty roughly. I was off base. This is my way of saying mea culpa, mea maxima culpa." "You were only doing your job," Ben replied. "I appreciate the gesture." "No grudges?" Manny asked. "No grudges," Ben agreed. 2 musicians in Georgian folk costumes strummed their balalaikas and belted out a Georgian folk song. A young waiter wearing an impeccable tuxedo rested a tray on a stand next to the table and began setting out the starters. "It's a kind of Georgian smorgasbord," Manny noted. He pushed a dish toward Ben. "The things wrapped in grape leaves are very spicy. Try one." Working their way through Georgian specialties, they finished off the 1st bottle of wine and started in on the 2nd. Manny got Ben talking about his background. He had been born and raised in a railroad town in upstate New York called Hornell and educated at Northwestern University outside Chicago. Well into the 2nd bottle of wine, Manny introduced a more personal note into the conversation by telling him about the death 5 years before of his wife of 25 years. Halfway through the 2nd bottle, Manny belched and refilled both glasses. Responding to a question, Ben told him briefly about his divorce, the subsequent custody battle that he lost, and the son he had back in the States. "Must have left you feeling pretty bitter about women," Manny noted. Ben smiled in grim agreement. Manny nodded sympathetically. Then, very casually, he remarked, "That lady poet of yours is quite a looker." Ben glanced up. "Should we be having this conversation here?" "Why do you think I took you to one of these new private restaurants? The folks tailing you can't afford to follow you inside and pay for a dinner. It's too expensive." "What if the table was bugged?" "I checked it out when I put the wine on the floor." "You think of everything," Ben observed. The way he said it, it didn't sound like a compliment. "I try to." Ben took another sip of wine. He seemed to want to talk. "The lady poet is a looker, as you put it. My instructions were to get involved with a Russian woman. Nobody said I had to pick a dog." "What's she like?" Ben filled his own glass and drank some more. "She's the best that this godforsaken country has," he said with emotion. "She's all soul and guts, and expects the worst and hopes for the best, and keeps beating her head against a wall and coming back for more." He remembered something Aida had told him in Leningrad. "She associates happiness with pain. She follows her heart until it breaks." The waiter collected the empty serving dishes and returned with full ones. Some American tourists at a nearby table burst out laughing. The balalaika music soared. Manny loosened his belt a notch and spooned some mushrooms onto Ben's plate, and then his own. "You don't need to tell me if you don't want to," he said over the noise. "I have a professional interest. I'm curious to know how they came at you. What did they do, threaten to send the lady poet away and break off the romance?" Ben decided there would be no harm in answering now that the security officer was on his side. "She's got a kid," he said presently. "The kid's got leukemia. He needs Western drugs to stay alive. It wasn't only a matter of ending the romance. They threatened to cut off his supply of medicine unless I cooperated." Manny whistled through his teeth. Talk about operational bonuses. Any woman would have done. But what a stroke of luck to fall on someone with a sick kid. He eyed Ben. "What's going to happen to the kid when you leave?" Ben leaned forward. "I thought about that," he confided eagerly. "Actually, I wouldn't mind having your opinion on something. I can tell you that the operation is over. She's delivering my last envelope now, which means they'll soon find a pretext to transfer me back to the States. When Penn hesitated, Manny nodded encouragement. I spent back-to-back tours running operations like this one out of Istanbul. If I can help you. I asked her to set up a last meeting at the safe house. What for? Ben gulped down some more wine. The waiter snatched away the empty bottle. Manny fetched the third bottle from under the table and handed it to the waiter, who opened it. Manny took the bottle back from the waiter and filled Ben's glass. Ben ran his finger around the rim for a while. Manny didn't push him. I figure I have a card to play, Ben said finally. The KGB is convinced that the Americans don't know I slipped them stuff. They will want to keep it that way. I plan to offer Victor. Victor? That's the name my KGB contact goes by. I plan to offer him a trade. My silence in return for an exit visa for the kid and his mother. Ben explained about the American doctor and the bone marrow transplant. What do you think? Manny pushed away his plate. Whatever. You don't like it? It's not a matter of liking it or not. It won't work. Why not? You've got to look at it from the KGB's point of view. Once the kid and his mother are out of the country, your friend Victor will lose his hold on you. And you can't outbluff Victor by threatening to expose yourself as a spy. He'll only threaten to cut off the kid's medicine if you turn yourself in. It'll be a standoff. What do you do then? Ben toyed with his food. You have a better idea? Cocking his head, Manny said carefully, Maybe. What is it? I'd need to know more about the operation, like, for instance, who's running you? Ben looked around to make sure nobody was within earshot. I was housekeeping for an Army Intelligence Cipher Unit in Washington. The CIA needed a fresh face and offered me a one-shot contract. What did they tell you about the purpose of the operation? The guy who briefed me said the information I leaked to the Russians would discredit the opposition to Glasnost and Perestroika. Manny angrily splashed some wine into his glass and downed it in one gulp. He snorted as he wiped his lips with the back of his hand. You've been had, he announced. Ben bridled. What is that supposed to mean? You sure you want to know? Ben wasn't sure, but he nodded anyhow. Manny nodded back. Okay, he said. And leaning over his plate, he told Ben that he had broken into his safe and read the thin notebook cover to cover. He told him about the tractor station and the one wife and one child and Ksenia and the Kalmyk and the access to Andropov and the connection to Dubček's speechwriter. He explained how the dates of the various trips abroad coincided. He told him about the promotion in 1985. It fits like a glove. You leaked hints to your friend, Victor. Each hint narrowed the list until there was only one name left on it. You're not discrediting his opponents, you're discrediting Gorbachev himself. All the stuff you leaked to the Ruskies pointed to him. You're supplying his enemies with phony evidence that the man who runs the country, the son of peasants who suffered under Stalin, hated the Soviet regime, and worked for the CIA for years to undermine it. According to the phony evidence, when he became numero uno, the CIA, out of prudence, broke off contact with him, figuring he'd finish the job himself. Ben's head was swimming. It's not possible. You're making it all up to confuse me. Manny shrugged his heavy shoulders. Whatever. Ben gazed at the table for a long time. He was thinking very hard. Manny nursed his drink. After a while, Ben looked up. Gorbachev's the one who's ending the Cold War. Why would the CIA want to kill him off? Manny snickered. You're not being run by the CIA, he said flatly. I spotted that notice on the inside cover of your notebook. If the book falls into the wrong hands, it should be sealed, labeled top secret, eyes only, and expedited by special diplomatic pouch addressed to Intelligence Support Activity, Pentagon, Washington, D.C., attention, Marlowe. Marlowe is the guy who recruited me and briefed me. Marlowe is the guy who sent me the notebook. A big man in his early 50s who talks with a Texas accent, has thin gray hair and uneven teeth that he hides by almost never smiling? Manny massaged the length of his nose with the side of his wine glass. Did you ever ask yourself what an intelligence support activity was? I assumed it was a mailbox for the CIA. A scornful laugh rose to the surface from Manny's stomach. He pulled a folded message blank out of his jacket pocket and read it again before passing it across the table. I cabled an old buddy of mine at DIA. When Ben looked puzzled, Manny said, "That's the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. Here's the answer I got back. The group in question is a Pentagon entity listed as a harmless intelligence support activity. It came into existence during the Carter presidency to deal with the Iranian hostage crisis. When the crisis ended, the support activity was disbanded, but like a lot of organizations that ceased to function, it seemed to have remained on the books. According to my buddy, there were rumors circulating in the late 80s that the support activity had been resurrected by some middle-ranking Pentagon officers. If I had to guess, I'd say the thing that attracted them to this dormant support activity was that it was not associated with either the Central Intelligence Agency or the Defense Intelligence Agency, which meant it was outside congressional oversight parameters. The fact that it was also outside White House oversight parameters, inasmuch as it didn't need a presidential finding to set its wheels in motion, would have made it even more appealing. The secret to who controls any organization is its funding. The intelligence support activities budget, so my friend says, is buried in the Joint Chiefs Contingency Fund under the heading Transportation Miscellaneous. The person in nominal charge is a Marine colonel attached to the long-term planning staff of the Joint Chiefs. The guy who runs the day-to-day ops goes by the name of Marlowe, but his real name is Asher Spink. Spink is a big man in his 50s, with thin, gray hair and uneven teeth that he hides by almost never smiling. He talks with a Texas drawl. Visibly shaken, Ben handed back the cable. "Do you know this Spink?" "We rubbed shoulders during one of my tours in Istanbul. He was a zealot. He loved the Cold War. He hated the Russians. He was obsessed with the idea that he could destroy communism by outspending the Russians in the arms race. The pressure to keep up would run the communist economies to the ground. In his distorted worldview, everything that increased tensions and therefore increased arms budgets was devoutly to be wished. Spink moved on from Turkey to head the Prague station from the late 60s to the mid-70s, where he may or may not have run an agent code named Silverweed. He must have come up with one harebrained scheme too many, because the CIA quietly pensioned him off. Last I heard of him, he was making per diem consulting for some crazies in the bowels of the Pentagon. Now this intelligence support activity thing turns up. Whatever. The Americans at the other table were tucking dollars under a saucer and heading noisily for the door. The balalaika player was taking a break, smoking a Marlboro in a corner. The waiter came over to clear away the dinner dishes and returned a few minutes later with a pastry tray and two cups of a thick liquid he described as coffee. When they were alone again, Ben said, "What are you telling me?" "I'm telling you, you're a first-class sap. You're the field hand for an illegal operation cooked up by a frustrated zealot named Spink and run out of the basement of the Pentagon by a shadowy support activity that doesn't have to account to anybody, not Congress, not the President, except the military." Manny was spitting out words now. God knows how high in the chain of command accountability goes. Spink could be whispering in the ear of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but he could just as well be whispering in the ear of some manic chicken colonel on the long-range planning staff, a Cold War junkie who's convinced it will damage American national interests, not to mention military careers and military-industrial profits, if Gorbachev is allowed to create the conditions for winding down the East-West confrontation. Ben, suddenly very sober, helped himself to the last of the wine and drank it off. Manny signaled for the bill and handed it back to the waiter without looking at it, along with his American Express card. The two men waited, silently, for the waiter to return. Manny scrawled his name on the receipt. "Thanks for the dinner," Ben said ironically. "My pleasure," Manny answered evenly. Walking back toward the diplomatic compound across from the Hotel Ukraine, Manny muttered matter-of-factly, "You're being followed." When Ben looked around in puzzlement, Manny said, "Don't get nervous. You're always followed. That's one of the things that first made me wonder about you. In case you're curious, it's the young couple ahead of us. I recognize the blonde. She was tailing you that time we walked down Gorky together." Concentrating on their thoughts, they turned right at the next intersection and walked without conversing for a long while. Manny finally broke the silence. "I want to ask you something." Ben, chewing on his lower lip, glanced at him. "What's really between you and the lady poet?" Ben said very quietly, "Somewhere along the way I fell in love with her." Manny responded very carefully, "That being the case, you may have a card to play after all." Ben perked up. "Here's the thing," Manny went on. "We're dealing with a rogue operation run outside the mainstream of accountability. Blowing the whistle on it is out of the question. The world would never believe it wasn't official Washington policy to undermine Glasnost. American credibility would be in shambles at a crucial moment in time. On the other hand, there is something you could do to stymie the plot and help the girl." Ben whispered, "I could go to prison for that." Manny turned on him. "There are people on our side who don't want the Cold War to end. They're afraid of becoming warriors without adversaries, so they're trying to get the Russians who think like them to dump Gorbachev. Remember the conversation we had at Sam's? I told you I didn't think the great Houdini could succeed, but I was all for giving him a fair shot at it. I still am." Embarrassed by his show of emotion, Manny shrugged. "Whatever." They jaywalked across Kutuzovsky Prospect and came within sight of the diplomatic compound. Suddenly, Ben grabbed Manny's elbow. The two men stood facing each other on the sidewalk as traffic raced past. "Tell me about the card you think I can play." Chapter 27. When it came to mounting an operation, Manny had the instinct of a choreographer. The entrances and the exits of the dancers, as well as their movements between, had to be meticulously planned. Above all, the performance had to take place on his stage. "Why?" Ben had asked when Manny insisted on this last point. "The person who chooses the stage," Manny had explained laconically, "dominates the stage." Which was why, when Victor finally despaired of Ben turning up at the third-floor apartment in the Stalin Gothic for the rendezvous Aida had arranged, he discovered an envelope on the floor outside the door. Pulling a sheet of white typewriter paper from the envelope, Victor read the hand-printed message. "By now you think you have figured out the identity of Ironweed. If you want to know the real end to the Ironweed story, come immediately to Kolominskoye. There is a long table with a red tablecloth and inkwells and documents in the chancellery room in the gatehouse. One of the documents is an envelope marked Victor. Inside the envelope you will find a message telling you where to meet me. I will be there only if you come alone." Manny and Ben, driving a Chevrolet from the embassy carpool, were well on their way to Kolominskoye, the summer residence of the Tsars some 10 miles southeast of the Kremlin, by the time Victor finished reading the letter. Frolov and Krostin were all for surrounding Kolominskoye with militiamen and extracting whatever information the American Bassett had by intimidation. Cooler heads, the old generals, Victor's, prevailed. Victor issued instructions to his section chiefs while his limousine was being summoned. "Kolominskoye," he told Zinkievich as he settled into the front seat of the Zill. "Kolominskoye?" Zinkievich asked in surprise. He had never known his boss to spend an afternoon sightseeing. "You heard me," Victor snapped. Gunning the motor, grinding gears, Zinkievich nosed the car out into traffic. His eyes hooded and thoughtful, Victor reached into the glove compartment, removed the Walter handgun he kept there, and inserted a clip of bullets. He checked to make sure the safety was on, then dropped the gun into the pocket of his khaki raincoat. From the top of the Georgievsky bell tower at Kolominskoye, Ben surveyed through Manny's binoculars the hordes of tourists wandering around the residence grounds. A steady stream of visitors poured into the Tsar's residence from outside the front gate, where the tourist buses and private automobiles and taxis parked. "There he is," Ben exclaimed excitedly. He handed the binoculars to Manny. "The big man in the khaki raincoat just getting out of the car. the one leaning over and saying something to the driver. Manny focused the binoculars on Victor as he turned and started toward the gate. Before being posted to Moscow, Manny had leafed through a dozen photograph albums of known KGB officers. The face of the man whom Ben called Victor was not familiar to him. As Victor made his way through the crowds toward the chancellery, Manny studied the parking lot. He noticed four private cars pulling up beyond the line of tourist buses. Two men got out of two of the cars and walked over to talk to each other. Manny passed the binoculars to Ben and pointed out the two men. Ben looked through the binoculars. "The pear-faced guy on the left is the one who was in the safe house the first time I went there," he said. Manny took the binoculars and trained them on Victor, who had stopped before the chancellery building and was looking around as if he expected to meet someone. Manny checked the parking lot again. The two men were standing with their backs to one of the four cars, waiting. They were obviously under instructions not to follow Victor onto the grounds of the residence. "It looks like he's alone," Manny decided. "Come on." In the chancellery building, Victor joined a line of visitors filing through the exhibit rooms. In one of the rooms, he spotted the long table with the red tablecloth. Inkwells and documents from the 17th century were scattered on the tablecloth. One of the envelopes was labeled in red ink, "Victor." As Victor passed, he snatched the envelope from the table. When the babushka sitting on a folding chair started to protest, Victor flashed his red identification booklet at her. Outside the chancellery, he tore open the envelope and read the note, then turned on his heel and headed straight for the Church of John the Baptist at the far end of the grounds near the Moscow River. The church, which Ivan the Terrible caused to be built to mark his anointment as Tsar, was similar to the onion-domed St. Basil's Cathedral in Red Square. It consisted of a central section surrounded by four smaller chapels, each with its own entrance. Following the instructions in the note, Victor found the chapel with the cord blocking the entrance and a piece of cardboard hanging from the cord on which was written, "Closed for repairs." He ducked under the cord and pushed through the door into the chapel. The inside was tenebrous. Thin beams of light stabbed through slits high in the thick walls. Coming out of the bright sunlight, Victor was blinded for a moment. The odor of burnt candles and incense stung his nostrils. Gradually, he made out a figure standing next to a latticework confessional. Walking up to him, Victor said, "You must have something important on your mind to go to all this trouble." Ben came straight to the point. "Ironweed is a disinformation operation," he announced. His tight voice ricocheted weakly off the icons covering the walls. Victor looked around to make sure they were alone, then inspected the face of the American Basset. He seemed to be slightly out of breath, as if he had been running, as if he had been invoking a great lie or a great truth. A spectrum of possibilities flashed before Victor's eyes. In his raincoat pocket, his fingers closed over the butt of the pistol. "My 4 months in Prague, my transfer to Moscow, the love affair with a Russian woman that would leave me open to blackmail, it was all part of a carefully arranged plot. I was instructed to give you junk mail until you tightened the screws. When you were convinced that you had turned me into a penetration agent, I was to start feeding you material on silverweed and ironweed. Why are you telling me this now?" "I want to negotiate a trade." "What are you offering?" "Proof that what I say is true. Proof that ironweed is a disinformation operation." "What is the nature of this proof?" "The notebook from which I copied all the ironweed and silverweed messages that I was supposed to be eradicating from the CIA station's backlist of sensitive compartmented information cables. Eventually, I could take a lie detector test to prove to you that there were no messages to eradicate, that the notebook was the source of the messages." "What do you want in return?" "Exit visas for the woman and her son. When they are both out of the country, I will supply you with the proof." Victor took a step backward. He cleared his throat, then started to speak in a voice that sounded ominously brittle. "Did it ever occur to you that we might not want the proof, that we prefer to believe you were sent to Moscow to eradicate messages which then fell into our hands, that we prefer to believe Ironweed was working for your CIA all these years, that we prefer to believe the CIA discovered you have been passing us the Ironweed messages and is trying to discredit the leak by having you claim you were part of a disinformation operation. Ben asked, how can you turn your back on the truth? Truth, Victor observed, is only useful if it is convenient. As he spoke, his right hand drifted out of the raincoat pocket. Ben gasped as he caught the bluish glint of the pistol. I have been reading excerpts from your newspapers, Victor said. All of them agree that conditions in Moscow have deteriorated. The criminal element is bolder than ever. Your death will be attributed to robbery. A junior American diplomat visiting the Tsar's summer residence was shot dead by someone desperate for the hard currency he carried in his wallet. With a little ingenuity, our detectives may even trace the bullet to a handgun owned by a known hoodlum who will admit the crime when your wallet is discovered in his possession. Victor thumbed the safety back and scooped up the hem of his raincoat and bunched it up against the muzzle of his pistol to dampen the sound of the shot. The adrenaline that had coursed through his veins the day he bayoneted the Wehrmacht soldier was again streaming through his body. The prospect of destroying an enemy was giving him a new high. You are an amateur who has waded in over his head, he snarled. Now you will lose your head. He started to extend the pistol when he heard a faint scuffling behind him. Suddenly he felt a hollow round object pressing into the back of his neck. The soft, gruff voice of someone who was clearly not an amateur drawled in his ear, above all, avoid sudden gestures. Do not drop the Volta. We would not want it to go off accidentally. Grip the barrel between your thumb and forefinger, yes, like that, fine. Now, slowly hold the pistol out to my friend. Very well done. I will take the weapon, Ben. Thank you. Manny, who had been hiding in the latticework confessional, replaced the cap on his fountain pen and slipped it back in his pocket. Aiming the Volta at the back of Victor's skull, he remarked, "And they say the Cold War is over." He snorted in derision. "It's just become more creative, coming up with a hoodlum who will admit to the crime, whatever." Ben leaned shakily against the confessional. "I guess you were wrong," he told Manny. I guess I didn't have a card to play. There was no way to know until you tried, Manny said. He slipped out of his sports jacket and carefully wound the sleeve around the Volta. Watching from the wall, Ben's eyes widened. What are you going to do? He whispered in alarm. Reaching up, Manny deftly swiped the cloth-covered pistol sharply across the back of Victor's head. He caught Victor under his arms and eased him gently to the tiled floor. What I am going to do, he calmly announced, is get you out of Russia. For that, you need a head start. Here, give me a hand. The two of them maneuvered Victor's limp body into the confessional. What if you killed him? Ben breathed. He swallowed hard. Manny shrugged his heavy shoulders into the sports jacket and dropped Victor's pistol into one of its pockets. The newspapers will say that a senior apparatchik working for the Komitet Государственной Безопасности, better known by its initials KGB, was mugged while visiting the Tsar's summer residence by someone desperate for the hard currency he carried in his wallet. He smiled down at Victor for a moment, enjoying his little joke. Inkerman, who subscribed to the theory that a good station chief didn't make waves, strode back and forth across his threadbare office carpet on his short legs, punctuating Manny's monologue with grunts of dissatisfaction. Every now and then he tossed a question over his shoulder as if it were a grenade and waited for the muffled explosion. You're sure about the identity of Ironweed? He asked at one point. Manny described how he had narrowed the list down to one and went on with his story. You're positive you didn't kill him? He asked after Manny described how he had gotten his head start. It was a love tap, Manny replied. How did you smuggle Bassett out of Kolominskoye? Inkerman wanted to know. They closed down the place at 6, Manny explained. We got lost in the flow of tourists, crowding through the gate toward the buses. The pear-faced man Bassett recognized through binoculars was still staring over the heads of the tourists when we pulled away. Manny, sprawling in a seat, threw a quick glance at the CIA station chief. The way I see it, Charlie, we've had our differences over the years, but this Ironweed business is another can of worms altogether. We've got to exfiltrate Bassett out of the country before the KGB heavies get their paws on him. Inkerman continued pacing. What I don't understand, he said, is why this Victor character would want to eliminate Bassett. I've been thinking about that, Manny said. What I came up with is this. Some folks in the Pentagon have decided the world would be better off without Glasnost and with the Cold War, so they mounted an operation to drop hints to the Russians that Gorbachev was a longtime CIA agent. The information fell into the hands of folks who are only too eager to believe this because they also think the world would be better off without Glasnost and with the Cold War. They plan to use the information Bassett slipped them to undermine Gorbachev, and when the time is ripe, dump him. So when Bassett comes along saying, "Hey, fellas, I was only kidding about the great Houdini being a CIA agent. What I passed you was part of a disinformation operation," he's telling them something they don't want to hear. For all we know, Victor and his friends may be Pamyat people. They couldn't care less if the messages Bassett slipped them are phony. The messages are a weapon they can use to get at Gorbachev. So what do? They kill the messenger and spare the messages. Inkerman reached across his desk and stabbed at a button on his intercom. "Miss Macy, order me up some wheels from the carpool." Squinting at Manny in the murky half-light of his office, Inkerman asked, "Where did you stash him?" Manny coughed up a guttural snicker. "I drove him out to a dacha near Zagorsk. Bassett said it was the secret hideaway of the Zavaskaya woman's ex-husband. We've got to assume that the KGB knows about it, but my guess is they won't get around to checking it until they've tried all the Moscow haunts first. Bassett's apartment, mine, yours, the embassy, whatever. Which gives us 3, maybe 4 hours to play with. The Zavaskaya woman and her kid are at the dacha for the weekend. Bassett will be waiting with them in an abandoned church near the dacha, as opposed to the dacha itself, on the off chance Victor's people turn up in Zagorsk before we do. But he swears he won't leave the country unless she goes with him, and she won't go without the kid. So you have got to figure a way to get the three of them out." Inkerman ran a sweaty palm over his scalp to slick back his hair. "I ought to be able to come up with something." Manny corrected him. "We ought to be able to come up with something." When Inkerman challenged him with a dark look, Manny added sweetly, "It's me who knows where the dacha and the abandoned church are located." Inkerman jerked his head in the direction of the door. "Tag along if it makes you feel useful." "Whatever." Lovers drained from something other than lovemaking, they sat with their backs against one of the rough stone walls of the abandoned church on the bluff overlooking the far end of the lake. Their eyes were shut, their faces turned up to the sun. Farther down the slope, Sava could be heard cracking open stones with an old hammer in search of fossils. Aida's voice, when she finally managed to speak, had grown hollow from listening to him. "So, your Russian is more or less correct. The words you use are in my vocabulary. But I am not sure I understand what is in the spaces between the words. Are you telling me that everything that happened between us on the train to Leningrad, in the hotel overlooking the Neva, here in the dacha, was part of someone's plan, was a figment of someone's imagination?" Her sentence trailed off, as if what she had said needed digesting. From the slope, Sava called up excitedly, "Aida, I found a billion-years-old snail fossil!" Aida waved at the boy, who turned back to the stones and continued cracking them open with his hammer. Her head, resting against the wall, rocked slowly until she was looking at Ben. "I feel as if I have been raped." Ben touched her ribs with his fingertips. "I love you, Aida. Whatever else has happened has not changed that. I ask you to believe me." She exhaled in frustration. "I do not know what to believe. At least believe me when I say you must leave the country." Covering her ears with her palms, Aida turned her head away and spit out some lines of Akhmatova. "I heard a voice call, 'Leave your remote and sinful country. Leave Russia behind forever. I covered my ears with my palms. "Do it for the boy," Ben pleaded. "He can have the bone marrow operation. His condition can be cured." Her palms slowly dropped away from her ears. "That is the one note of your siren song that reaches me." "It's not only for the bone marrow operation that you must leave," Ben argued. "Victor was going to kill me. If they kill me, they will want to eliminate you, eliminate Sava." He had to look away when he saw the expression of sheer terror in her eyes. He said weakly, "They are not the kind of people who leave loose ends." Aida watched Sava hacking away at the rocks. "You are trying to frighten me into going with you," she added softly, "and it is working. If I could undo what has been done." Aida thrust out her wrist so that he could see the watch that ran counterclockwise. "So, if time ran backward," she told him bitterly, "you could go back in time and undo the future. You could fix things so that things did not need to be fixed." Confronted with her bitter reproach, Ben couldn't bring himself to speak. Below them, the sound of hammering suddenly broke off. Sava was rising to his feet and staring at two men struggling up the slope through the high grass. Ben immediately recognized them. "Help is on the way," he told Aida. He stood and reached out to help Aida up. Ignoring his hand, she climbed to her feet and started down the slope past the two men to collect Sava. Inkerman, in his shirt sleeves, his jacket folded over one arm, came up to Ben. Manny, still wearing his jacket, sweat stains visible around the collar of his shirt, stopped a few paces behind. Inkerman drew his forearm across his brow to wipe away the perspiration. "Fucking hot out," he commented. Ben didn't say anything. Inkerman patted the pockets of his jacket, looking for something, found it, pulled out a pair of handcuffs, which he dangled from a finger. "I am sending you back to the States under arrest," he informed Ben. Keeping his beady eyes glued to Ben, he turned his head so that Manny could hear him. "I figured it all out, Manny. If I arrest him and send him back in irons, the Russians will assume we caught him in the act, which will convince them that the stuff he passed them is genuine." Ben asked Inkerman, "What about her and the boy?" Perspiration glistened on the station chief's scalp. "She's not my problem. The kid's not my problem. You are my problem." Ben addressed Manny over Inkerman's shoulder. "You gave me your word." With a practiced flick of his wrist, Inkerman snapped open the handcuffs. Behind him, Manny mopped his brow with his sleeve and then took off his jacket and wound it around the metal object in one of the pockets. Stepping up behind Inkerman, he deftly swiped the cloth-covered pistol sharply across the back of his head. He caught Inkerman under his arms and eased him into a sitting position in the shade of a wall. Then he retrieved the handcuffs and snapped them on the station chief's pale ankles. "When he comes to, he will be able to walk," he told Ben, "but slowly." Ben said nervously, "You are a specialist in head starts." "This time, I'm going to need it as much as you," Manny noted grimly. He stared down morosely at the CIA station chief. "The trouble is, without his help, I haven't the dimmest idea what to do with the head start." Aida, gripping Sava's hand in hers, had come up behind Manny. Speaking in English, so as not to alarm the boy, she said, "I maybe know who can be helping us in the leaving of the country." Chapter 28. Vadim had been nipping moonshine most of the day, but the sight of Aida's face as she pushed past him into the penthouse apartment had sobered him instantly. Now he cast haunted looks in the direction of the two Americans as his ex-wife, whispering intently, told him what had happened. The big one there bunched up his jacket and hit the other one over the head with something and attached bracelets to his ankles so he could not follow us when he came to and drove us back to Moscow in the embassy car, and here we are. "And here you are," Vadim repeated without enthusiasm. Aida found it difficult to continue. Since the events on the bluff overlooking the far end of the lake, she had been plagued with bouts of dizziness. She pressed a palm to her forehead and fought to bring her breathing under control. After a while, she managed to add, "Benedict says we must get ourselves out of the country before the KGB catches up with us." The mention of the KGB really alarmed Vadim. "I don't see how I can help you. Aida darted over to an open door to check Sava, who had fallen asleep, fully dressed, on the waterbed Vadim had bought from a departing diplomat. The sight of the boy curled up in a fetal position provoked deep feelings of guilt in her. What had she been thinking of to put him at risk for her own carnal satisfaction? She turned back to Vadim. "So, if not you, who?" she asked gravely. "If you turn us away, I will of course understand it. But you must know we have reached the end of the line." "What about seeking asylum in the American Embassy?" The man whose ankles are bound in bracelets was from the American Embassy. "They consider Benedict a traitor. As for Sava, as for me, they could not care less about our fate." Vadim heaved himself out of his chair and started prowling around the living room, glancing from time to time at the two Americans sitting tensely on the couch, at Aida slumped in a quilted easy chair. Stopping in his tracks, he began gesturing. Failing to find words to accompany the gestures, he continued prowling around the room, absently brushing his fingertips across his prized possessions. There was a Japanese hi-fi. There was a German video recorder. There was a French fax machine that switched automatically between phone calls and fax calls, as if he were weighing what he had to lose by helping her. He stopped in front of a picture window to study the pinpoints of light dancing on the surface of the Moscow River below, as if the pinpoints could tell him in some sort of Morse code what to do. The two Americans exchanged looks. Ben tried without success to catch Aida's eye. As for Aida, she kept shaking her head as she tried to run time backward in her mind and discover at what instant she could have slipped free of the trap in which she now found herself. Vadim, still prowling, trailed two fingers over a table, leaving parallel tracks in the dust. Then he touched the silver samovar he had bought only days before in an impromptu flea market set up on the ground floor of a factory dormitory. Scouring Moscow for a Japanese television camera, Vadim had spotted the samovar resting on a closed cardboard suitcase. A thin-faced, cross-eyed young Armenian refugee from Azerbaijani pogroms in the Caspian city of Baku had stared up at Vadim with his good eye. "I am practically giving it away," he had announced. The samovar had reminded Vadim of the one his mother had polished every Sunday of her life, until the day she traded it to a doctor in return for radiation treatments for her husband. "How much is practically giving it away?" he had inquired with studied disinterest. "Make me an offer," the Armenian had retorted gloomily. In the end, they had dickered for a quarter of an hour before Vadim pulled out his packet of foreign banknotes, peeled off 10 American dollars and 10 English pounds, and tucked the samovar under an arm. While they were dickering, the Armenian had rambled on. "We packed our bags and ran for it," he had recounted with undisguised bitterness. "We left behind my 3-room apartment, and my Danish furniture, and my Japanese TV, and my wife's French knitting machine, and her German blending machine that makes carrot juice when you can find carrots." He had added Vadim's dollars and pounds to a meager wad in the breast pocket of a threadbare suit jacket. "You look like someone who recognizes opportunity when it knocks. You would not by any chance be interested in selling a Moscow residence permit or ration coupons or subletting a room in your apartment. Around here," he had added, gesturing toward the other Armenians selling silver and candlesticks and clothing and books from open suitcases, "people will do anything for these things." The Armenians' anything had registered in a lobe of Vadim's brain. Since his visit to the open-air flea market, Vadim had come across newspaper articles describing the plight of the Armenian refugees. There were roughly 30,000 of them in Moscow, camping in hallways of public buildings and outlying shacks and factory dormitories and the abandoned hulls of scuttled riverboats. The Moscow City Council, anxious to eliminate the eyesore, not to mention the strain in the ability of Moscow to supply food to its legal residents, had passed an ordinance requiring the refugees to move on by the end of the month. The Kremlin, meanwhile, had laid on free transportation back to Baku in an effort to get the refugees to return to their homes. Sinking onto a chair, Vadim eyed the two Americans. He remembered the item he had read on one of Pravda's inside pages. The first train carrying Armenians back to Baku was scheduled to leave Moscow at the end of the week. "Maybe I can help you, after all," he heard himself say.
You are a great man, Vadim, Aida called from across the room. I am doing it for the boy, Vadim said gruffly. And leaning toward the two Americans, he described his meeting with the Armenian and spelled out the plan that had come to him. He even had an idea of how to dispose of the embassy Chevrolet so that it would never be found. Manny liked the idea right off. If you can get us to Rostov-on-Don, he said, I can get us across the frontier. When I was running agents from Turkey, my main contacts were two Cossacks, twin brothers who ran a smuggling operation out of Rostov. For a price, they could get anything, or anybody, in or out of the country. Last I heard, they were still in business. An anxious Ben poked holes in Vadim's plan. What if they scrutinized the internal passports at the railroad station, he asked. Unlikely, Vadim said. Who in his right mind would return to Baku if he wasn't obliged to? What if some of the Armenians denounce us? The odds are against that. The Armenians blame the authorities for what happened to them. If you told your average Armenian what you were doing, chances are he would help you out of spite. We will need hard currency, and lots of it, Manny put in. Some you can get from disposing of the car, Vadim told him. I can give you whatever else you need. Aida suddenly said, Come with us, Vadim. With a forlorn smile, she added, In America, the beautiful, the streets are paved with Sony Walkmans. What would I do in America the Beautiful? Vadim asked plaintively. You always wanted to work on Madison Street, Aida reminded him. Vadim shook his head sadly. What would a Russian Jew like me know about advertising products that worked? I would run ideas up flagpoles and nobody would salute. Anyway, I have made it here. I have more money than I can spend. I can buy or trade for anything under the sun. And then there is Katya. She would be lost without me. He tried to change the subject. Have you heard the latest about the Jew being summoned to the visa office to discuss his application to emigrate to Israel? I have two reasons for wanting to leave, he tells the official. Every night my neighbor comes home drunk and starts cursing the Jews. He says that as soon as the communists are overthrown, he and his Pomyat friends will string up all the Jews. We communists will never be overthrown, the visa officer assures him, at which point the Jew says, That's my second reason for wanting to emigrate. Ha! Vadim disappeared into the kitchen and emerged with a plate filled with salami and cheese and pickles and thinly sliced black bread. Working on his second cheese sandwich, Ben thought of another objection to Vadim's plan. What if they won't let us leave the train at Rostov, he asked. What if the Cossacks Manny knew are no longer in business? What if, Vadim repeated in exasperation. Your plan has flaws, Ben insisted nervously. It's not perfect, Manny admitted. But like the man says, the perfect is the enemy of the good. Whatever. While Aida and the boy waited in Vadim's taxi, Manny, following Vadim's directions, maneuvered the embassy Chevrolet through a labyrinth of streets behind the sprawling exhibition of economic achievements. Turning into a pitted alleyway, he cut the motor in front of a rundown garage. Vadim took a quick sip from a silver flask, then reached over and honked the horn once. Seeing no sign of life, Ben said from the back seat, Are you sure we've come to the right place? A bearded Kazakh in dirty overalls, his forearms covered with tattoos, the tattoos smeared with grease, appeared in a small door that opened in the garage door. He waved to Vadim and disappeared back into the garage. A moment later, the garage door swung slowly open. Manny shifted into first and eased the Chevrolet into the garage. He killed the motor as the garage door closed behind them, cutting off most of the light. Four Kazakhs in dirty overalls surrounded the Chevrolet as Manny and Vadim and Ben climbed out. These guys are tough customers, Vadim said in English under his breath. Stay close. Another Kazakh, dressed in a rumpled black suit, appeared from behind huge drums of oil. Walking up to the car, he kicked at one of the wheels with a scuffed suede shoe. Tires have bad treads, he sneered. You never said nothing about bad treads. Vadim smelled trouble. We agreed on the price, he said. He backed up until he was standing between Ben and Manny. All three had their backs against the Chevrolet. The four men in overalls closed in on them. Do not try to reopen negotiations now, Vadim added bravely. How can I be expected to fix a price till I see the car in question? Asked the man in the rumpled suit. How? Agreed the Kazakh with the tattoos on his forearms. He bent and picked up a large red monkey wrench, which he hiked onto his shoulder. 400 United States of America dollars, 75 English pounds, 1,000 French francs is what we agreed on, Vadim said. One kopeck less, we take our business elsewhere. Another Kazakh scooped a tire iron off the concrete floor. I might see my way clear to paying 200 United States dollars, said the man in the rumpled suit. 200? You will get 10 times that when you break the car up and sell the spare parts. Let's get out of here, Manny muttered. He reached for the door handle. Behind him, he heard a sharp snap. He turned back. A rusty knife was in the hand of the third Kazakh. Look, fellas, I don't mind the occasional knife, but I draw the line at rusty blades, Manny said. Cut somebody with that thing, he could come down with a fatal case of tetanus. He brought up a laugh from his stomach, just as his hand brought up the Walter pistol from his pocket. The Kazakhs backed off and looked at their employer. Nobody said nothing about a gun, one of them mumbled. Manny gestured with the pistol. The monkey wrench, the tire iron, the rusty knife clattered to the concrete floor. Shrugging, the man in the rumpled suit kicked at the tire again. The treads are maybe not as bad as I thought, he conceded. The sight of her boss's head swathed in gauze had been too much for Viktor's secretary, Evgenia Leonovna. Tears had welled up in her eyes as she hovered over his hospital bed, stirring a second spoonful of her homemade confiture into an herb tea that she swore was good for dizzy spells, fingernails, and bowel movements. "Nothing is sacred anymore," she had exclaimed. "To think you were attacked in a church! The hooligan who did that ought to be put up against a wall!" Viktor's wife had been more suspicious. Summoned to the special KGB hospital where Viktor's head had been stitched up, Ekaterina had pushed him in a wheelchair to his limousine and had helped Zinkievich maneuver him into the front seat. "What were you doing in the church of John the Baptist way out at Kolominskoye?" she had asked as they headed back toward the airport and their apartment. Because of Zinkievich, she had refrained from commenting when Viktor trotted out the story about his having gone on the spur of the moment to offer up a candle to his dead mother at her favorite church. Back in the apartment, she had dissolved the yellowish powder the doctor had given her in tepid water and had handed the glass to Viktor, who was propped up on pillows in bed. "Now that we are alone," she had said, "you will tell me the truth. What is her name? How long have you been seeing her?" "I swear to you, dear Viktor, you are such a lousy liar. You have not set foot in a church in 50 years. Are you forgetting that we have an arrangement? Your having a mistress will not change things between us. I only want to know about it." "There was no woman," Viktor had said tiredly. "I was meeting an agent, if you must know. Obviously, I am unable to tell you more." Even then, she had only half believed him. "Obviously. I am very," he searched for the right word, "attached to you, Katya. If there was another woman, I would tell you. After all, you have your lover. There is no reason why I should not have a mistress." "None," she had agreed. She had reached up, and in a rare display of affection, had touched the gauze with her fingertips. "I would not like to be in his shoes when you find the man who did this to you." "Nor would I," Viktor had agreed grimly. At the office the next day, the old general was extremely solicitous. "My daughter tells me you suffer dizzy spells," he said. "That is to be expected with minor concussions. You need time off, a week of fresh mountain air." Viktor blinked rapidly to keep the general in focus. "I would not want to miss the denouement," he insisted. Which explained why Viktor, his head wrapped in clean bandages, the stitches had been removed by the same KGB doctor who had put them in, his joints aching with gout, his lids blinking rapidly to keep the dizziness at bay, found himself taking part in the night-long meeting of the Pamyat Directorate devoted to ironweed. Summoned by the old general for what was billed as an extraordinary session, the 18 high-ranking officers and former officers of the Komitet Государственной Безопасности had descended from the four corners of the country on the dilapidated hunting lodge tucked away in a thick stand of white birches off the Moscow-Kiev highway. There was no preliminary banter, no refreshments, no anecdotes about past triumphs. It was Stalin who formulated the rule of thumb that an enemy had to be eliminated politically before he could be eliminated physically, the general announced in his gravelly voice. In front of each of you is a copy of a dossier with the word ironweed on the first page. The contents of this dossier will ruin President Gorbachev politically. When that has been accomplished, we will see to his physical elimination. You all know the very talented head of our second chief directorate, Viktor Prosyenko. Viktor here will walk you through the dossier. When he has finished, you will understand why Gorbachev's days are numbered. The old man gestured toward his son-in-law with his deformed hand. Viktor. Swaying slightly, gripping the edge of the table to steady himself, Viktor rose to his feet. The dossier before you contains irrefutable evidence that Gorbachev has been an active agent of American imperialism since 1967. Several of the men around the table gasped. Viktor waited for the murmur to subside before continuing. You will see that he was known to the Americans by the code name Ironweed. When he became Secretary General in 1985, the Americans broke off contact in order to protect him. They were counting on the new Secretary General, who bore a lifelong grudge against our system, to reform communism out of existence. In this he has almost succeeded, but our feeling is that it is not too late to set the clock back. Once you have digested the information in this dossier, you will return to your various constituencies and spread the word. This dossier will create the ripple that will drown Gorbachev. People who have supported him up to now, once they learn of his treason, will abandon him. When we finally manage to depose him, the West will conclude that he was devoured by the revolution he launched. They will say he was ousted by those who were opposed to his economic program, who thought he had proceeded with reforms too rapidly or too slowly. But those of us who belong to Pamyat will know the real reason he was dethroned, because he is a traitor to the motherland. Breathing deeply, Viktor flipped open his own dossier. The first inkling we had that the Americans had been running a high-level agent in place came when... The old general had been categoric. It was preferable that the American Bassett did not leave Russia alive. KGB agents at the airports and the border crossing points had been alerted to look for the American, thought to be traveling with a woman in her early 40s and an 11-year-old boy named Sava. The American was thought to be armed with a Volta service pistol. An operational code had been assigned to the alert indicating that the American in question, along with anyone accompanying him, was to be detained in absolute secrecy until receipt of further instructions from the center. The old general cast the net wide. Tips came in from various corners of the country. A man speaking Russian with an American accent had been seen driving out of Leningrad on the Viborg Road. A woman and young boy were believed to be passengers in the car. An American with a passport identifying him as Ben Bass had registered at a hotel in Brest-Litovsk. A woman and a young boy had been seen putting a man fitting Bassett's description on a train at Lvov. So it went. Each tip was checked out. Each proved to be a case of overactive imagination or mistaken identity. 3 days passed. More tips accumulated. Each wound up in a dead end. Then, on Thursday, Viktor's section chief, Krostin, phoned in. He had questioned the housewife who shared the flat with the Zavaskaya woman and had learned that she had been asked to forward mail addressed to the poet's former husband, who now had an apartment of his own. Krostin had the address and wanted Viktor's permission to nose around. Krostin called back later in the morning to say that one of Vadim's neighbors had reported seeing a man fitting Bassett's description along with a woman and a young boy entering the building the night that Viktor was assaulted in the church. There had been another man, heavy-set, on the short side with them. Krostin supposed that it must be the man who sneaked up behind Viktor in the church and hit him over the head. On the off chance that the American and the Zavaskaya woman were still in the apartment, Krostin had brought in 2 carloads of agents and surrounded the building. Don't do anything until I get there, Victor ordered. 20 minutes later, Victor, the gauze on his head replaced by now with a small bandage, found Krostin in the lobby of the building. I had one of my people phone upstairs pretending he was taking a political survey, Krostin told his boss. His lips offered up an unaccustomed smile. The Jew is at home. I will see him alone, Victor told Krostin. Victor tried the elevator, but there was no response when he pushed the button. Breathing heavily, resting on each landing, he made his way up 9 flights to the top floor. There were 2 apartments. He checked the nameplate under the first bell, then rang it. When there was no response, he rang more insistently. He could hear footsteps approaching. The door opened as far as a safety chain permitted. Vadim, bleary-eyed, pink-skinned, peered out. He was wearing a crimson dressing gown and carrying a glass filled with ice cubes and some sort of thick, clear liquid. Thinking he was confronting a salesman, he quipped, "I am a seller, not a buyer." Victor held up a laminated card with his thumb covering his family name. Catching sight of the KGB logo on the card, Vadim put on a brave front. "I thought you people were all job hunting." Victor gestured with a forefinger. "Open it." Vadim managed to tinkle the ice cubes in his glass insolently before slowly unlatching the door. Victor brushed past him into the living room. He took in the view of the Moscow River, the furniture, the Japanese hi-fi, the German video recorder, the French fax machine. He took in the photograph of an exquisite-looking woman in a silver frame propped up on a mahogany table behind the couch. He had the same photograph of the same woman in the same silver frame on the desk in his office. Then he turned and took in Vadim. Vadim could not miss the bandage on his visitor's scalp. "Hurt our head, have we?" he inquired with exaggerated concern. He sank onto the couch and crossed his legs and rattled the ice cubes again. "Have you heard the latest joke about the difference between the KGB and the CIA? Victor seated himself on the quilted easy chair. "If it would make you feel more at ease, by all means tell it. The KGB has stolen from a CIA safe the blueprints for all American weapons systems developed during the past 10 years. The CIA has stolen from the KGB safe the results of all Soviet elections for the next 10 years. Ha! Victor did not crack a smile. Vadim, his eyes pink from too much drink, said, "You don't get it?" "I get it. I don't think it is funny." "How about the one where a KGB officer denies a Jewish computer programmer permission to emigrate to Israel on the grounds that he knows state secrets?" "What secrets?" the programmer asks. "Everyone knows the Americans are 20 years ahead of us in computer programming." "That's the secret," says the KGB officer. "Ha!" When Victor still didn't smile, Vadim burped in annoyance. "You are obviously not in a good mood. Let's talk, as the Americans say, chicken or turkey. To what do I owe the dubious pleasure of this visit? You are the former husband of Zinaida Zavaskaya?" Vadim nodded carefully. "When is the last time you saw her?" Vadim screwed up his eyes and thought. "We had lunch in the TV tower a few weeks ago." "And you have not seen her since?" Vadim shook his head. "According to one of your neighbors, the Zavaskaya woman, accompanied by her son Sava, and 2 men, one of them fitting the description of an American diplomat named Bassett, were seen entering the building 4 nights ago. Vadim treated himself to a healthy drink, then rattled the ice cubes in the glass again to gain time. "If it was her, which is not certain, she must have been visiting someone else in the building because she did not come up here." Against his will, Victor let his eyes drift to the photograph in the silver frame. The woman who gazed out with a thin, arrogant smile was breathtakingly beautiful. What could she possibly see in someone like Vadim? "The people who record history more often than not miss the important details," Victor informed Vadim. "They tell you what a general said, but not what he had for breakfast. They don't describe the state of his bowels or nerves. They don't tell you that Napoleon had diarrhea before the Battle of Borodino, that he did not sleep the night before because his anus itched. What is all that if some observer were recording this event, this encounter between a decorated veteran of the great patriotic war, a lieutenant colonel of the KGB in charge of the second chief directorate, and an... Victor spit out the word. Alcoholic, yid, black marketeer. With an effort, he forced himself to speak normally. What would he see? He would see a bandage on the head of the colonel covering 5 stitches that closed a wound caused when the same colonel was slugged by a Walter pistol wrapped in a suit jacket. He would note that the colonel had since suffered severe headaches that rendered him irritable, short-tempered, testy, a state not ameliorated when the colonel in question, interviewing the alcoholic yid black marketeer in question, recognized a photograph in a silver frame. Victor leaned forward. How long have you been fucking Katya? I do not have to answer that, Vadim said huskily. You do not have to answer because I know the answer. You have been fucking her for 4 years and 4 months. You met while she was filming a television series in Alma-Ata. You were buying cotton on the black market and having it privately packaged and selling it to pharmacies at 4 times the price you paid. Vadim gulped down the rest of his drink. How do you know such things? The woman in the silver frame is named Ekaterina Prosenka. She is married to Viktor Prosenko. It is, as they say, a very small world, Vadim. I am the cuckolded husband, Viktor Prosenko. For the first time, Vadim was really frightened. She said you had an arrangement. We did have an arrangement. She had her lovers, of whom you are the most recent, and I put up with it so that she would not leave me. Victor smiled a cruel smile. About the Zavaskaya woman and the American Bassett. Where did they go when they left here? I cannot tell you. You mean you will not tell me? Vadim made no answer. Victor said, You will have seen in the newspapers that we are still punishing people for economic misconduct in what is left of our Soviet Union. The list of your economic crimes is as long as my arm. It is illegal to hire taxis by the year and pay the driver in dollars. It is illegal to lease riverboats from the state under a new law intended for farmers who want to rent land. It is illegal to buy huge quantities of cotton and package it for sale to pharmacies at exorbitant prices. You will be tried for black marketeering and profiteering. You will be found guilty by the 3 judges who preside over the court. You will be sentenced to be executed. You will be shot by a firing squad. Katya will mourn your death. In due time, she will find another lover to take your place. Victor stood up and walked over to the telephone and rested a hand on it. About the Zavaskaya woman and her friends, where did they go when they left here 4 nights ago? His knees trembling uncontrollably, Vadim slowly raised his chin. Have you heard the one about what America the Beautiful and the Soviet Union have in common? The ruble is not worth anything, and neither country is what they have in common. And he added, almost inaudibly, Huh. Victor's section chief brought Vadim's taxi driver, Dmitri, in for questioning later that night. A meatball of a man with a pockmarked face, he stood in front of Victor's desk, shifting his weight from one foot to the other, squinting into Victor's desk lamp, which had been angled up so that it almost blinded him. State your name, Krostin instructed. Lifshitz, Dmitri. State your occupation. Taxi driver. State your religion. Dmitri mumbled something. I did not hear you. Israelite. Victor picked up the questioning. Do you know a person by the name of Vadim? Dmitri threaded the sweatband of his cap through his fingers. I have driven him around Moscow from time to time. Victor laughed under his breath. In fact, Vadim hires you by the year. In fact, he pays you in American dollars. Dmitri started to deny the accusation, but Victor cut him off. Let us be clear with each other. I am not concerned with your black market activities. I am concerned with Vadim's black market activities. I am going to put some questions to you. If you answer them honestly and fully, you will walk out of here a free man. If not... Dmitri, thoroughly cowed, said, I need to sit down. Victor motioned to Krostin. He pushed over a straight-backed wooden chair whose front legs had been slightly shortened. Dmitri collapsed into it, then tensed as he began to slide forward. Victor said, You are familiar with Vadim's former wife, Zinaida Zavaskaya, and her son Sava? Dmitri's head bobbed in reluctant acknowledgement.
4 nights ago, Vadim, the Zavaskaya woman and her son, as well as 2 other men, were passengers in your taxi. It had not been put as a question which indicated to Dmitri that the colonel already knew the answer. Again, Dmitri's head bobbed. Where did you drive them?
Dmitri tossed a nervous look over his shoulder at Krustin, then turned back to Viktor behind his desk. All he could make out was a silhouette.
Vadim left word for me to come by around 10 at night.
He and the ex and the boy came down, but they did not ride in my taxi at the start. They joined 2 men in an American Chevrolet. Vadim signaled for me to follow the Chevrolet. I parked on the main street near the Exhibition of Economic Achievements. Vadim dropped off the ex and the boy. They waited in my taxi. About 15 minutes later, Vadim and the 2 others came back. Vadim was counting money. It was then that they all squeezed into my taxi.
Describe the 2 men with Vadim.
I unfortunately did not get a good look at them.
Describe them, Dmitri.
Staring at his shoes, Dmitri did as he was told. When he finished, Viktor addressed his section chief.
Now we know who hit me over the head.
He wrote a name on a scrap of paper and passed it to Krustin, who read it and nodded. On the paper, Viktor had written Emmanuel Custer.
What happened to the Chevrolet? Krustin wanted to know.
Dmitri shrugged.
Vadim said something about having sold it to some Kazakhs for spare parts. He told the others it would be impossible to trace the car once it had been broken up.
Where did you take them after they all squeezed into your taxi? Asked Viktor.
Dmitri looked down at his cap, then up again at the silhouette behind the desk.
How do I know you will let me go if I tell you what you want to know?
You do not know.
Dmitri chewed on a thumbnail.
Finally, he said,
I let them off at a dormitory behind a textile factory in the Lefortovo district, the one where they put up all those Armenian refugees from Baku. An hour or so later, Vadim returned alone and I drove him back to his apartment.
Armenian refugees, Viktor said thoughtfully. That's how he is going to get them out. At the American embassy, cables were flying back and forth between Moscow and Washington. 2 members of the embassy were unaccounted for. The CIA station chief himself had disappeared for 36 hours, had turned up, the ends of handcuffs tucked into his socks so they would not rattle when he walked, with a tale of regaining consciousness on a hill overlooking a lake near Zagorsk, of breaking the chain on the cuffs with a rusty axe he found in a barn, of hitchhiking back to Moscow in the back of a truck full of pigs. One whiff of his clothing was enough to prove that the last detail of his story, at least, was accurate. Even before the handcuffs were cut off his ankles, Inkerman had enciphered a report to his masters in Washington. A barrage of replies was on its way back almost immediately. One came directly from the basement situation room of the White House. Deciphered, paraphrased, it said, "Haven't you heard? The Cold War is over. And we do not, repeat, do not want some inept embassy people reminding Americans who will soon be going to the polls that this might not be entirely true. In other words, do not rock the boat." The story was accordingly put out to curious embassy hands that the 2 missing diplomats were not missing at all. They were said to be visiting Leningrad and were probably wandering around the 10,000 rooms of the Hermitage. Certainly there was no cause for alarm. Inkerman, meanwhile, massaged the bruises on his ankles. The handcuffs had been cut off by the in-house plumber using an acetylene torch, and put out feelers with his web of sub-agents who were paid on a per diem basis and only too glad to find work. Pretty soon the station chief had picked up rumors that the KGB had gone to a full alert. Its people were reportedly combing Moscow hotels and brothels and airports, hunting for an American who bore a striking resemblance to Benedict Bassett. Inkerman even heard from a source inside the KGB that the center's agents were under orders not to bring the American in alive. Inkerman was not stupid. Custer, he understood, had gotten it right. Someone in Washington had leaked things to the Russians through Bassett that some Russians wanted to believe. Well, it suited Inkerman. Let the Russians dispose of Bassett and the asshole Custer at the same time. The bodies of the 2 of them would probably be discovered in a car that had skidded off a wet highway into a ravine and exploded.
Autopsies would be performed when the bodies were returned to the States. But if the Russians turned out to be as proficient as they had been at the height of the Cold War, there would be no traces of the real cause of death. At least, that was how Inkerman would have handled the problem if he had been in their shoes.
Chapter 29. Crammed into a narrow compartment he and Aida shared with an Armenian family, Ben dozed, his head drumming lightly against the back of the slatted wooden bench in time to the motion of the train. He stirred when Aida, puffing away on one of her hand-rolled cigarettes, returned from the toilet. She had had to wait 3/4 of an hour to use the railway car's only bathroom. "I almost threw up because of the odor," Aida whispered as she squeezed in next to Ben on the bench. "I lit up to drown out the stench." The Armenian husband and wife and the wife's two sisters jammed onto the benches with them, and the two teenage boys sleeping on the floor rearranged their limbs. Outside the rain-stained window, a gently rolling blur of wooded hills, illuminated by a sliver of moon darting in and out of dark clouds, flitted past. Ben glanced at his wristwatch.
"We should be passing through Voronezh sometime this morning," he said. The mere mention of Voronezh had an impact on Aida. Her mouth fell open, and she gazed out the window the way she might have looked at a promised land. So it was to Voronezh that our Mandelstam was exiled during the last 5 years of his life, she whispered.
Akhmatova visited him there in 1936, after which she wrote 4 of the most painful lines in a poetry overflowing with painful lines, and pressing her lips against his ear, Aida recited, "In the room of the banished poet, fear and the muse stand watch by turn, and the night falls without the hope of dawn." The touch of Aida's lips against his ear aroused erotic memories. Ben remembered how on the train to Leningrad a lifetime ago she had fogged the compartment window with her breath, and reaching up had written, "Lucidity must yield to lust." Would lucidity ever yield to lust again? It made his heart ache to think that it might not. What a fool he had been to play a game with a woman who had allowed him to live his wildest fantasies. He slipped a hand under the rough khaki blanket draped like a shawl over her and touched her thigh, but she only turned to offer him a bittersweet half-smile, as if she too were pondering what might have been. It had been like that between them. His advances had been fended off with ambiguous half-smiles since they had gone to ground in the prefabricated gray concrete dormitory behind a textile factory in Moscow's Lefortovo district. Stepping over the legs of Armenians sprawled on straw pallets in the hallway, Vadim had led them to a door with a card tacked to it that read, "Social Club. Participation in the dormitory's monthly amateur night is invited and required." Inside, rough khaki army blankets had been hung from electric wire stretched taut between the walls, dividing the social club into a warren of small compartments. Vadim had scouted around to find the one he had rented, and the four of them, Aida, Ben, Manny, and the boy, had camped on the tattered cushions and straw pallets that came with the cubicle. Once, and sometimes twice a day, Vadim would turn up with something under his arm, a plastic shopping sack filled with black bread and margarine and several tins of sardines, second-hand clothing for them to change into so they would pass for Armenian refugees, a scissors to cut their hair short so they would be harder to recognize, round eyeglasses to disguise the two men. Late one night, with hacking coughs and snoring and the unmistakable gasps of a woman making love coming from the blanketed compartments around them, Vadim had handed out internal passports that identified them as Armenians, along with official government affidavits authorizing them to travel at the state's expense back to Baku. Manny turned the documents over in his fingers. "Where did you get them?" he had demanded. "I inherited them," Vadim had replied with a twinkle. "The person I inherited them from inherited some of my Deutsche Marks in return." The morning they were due to start for the railroad station, Vadim had arrived lugging 3 cardboard suitcases. Setting them down on the floor, he had proceeded to pull his treasures out one by one. There had been a supply of Swedish biscuits and goat cheese and fermented goat's milk in a worker's thermos, and a sack of oranges and 6 Belgian chocolate bars for Sava.
There had been more clothing and more hard currency, thick wads of dollars and pounds and francs and Deutsche Marks, which Vadim delivered into Manny's safekeeping. There had even been drawing paper and colored crayons for the boy. "You are a magician," Sava had exclaimed as he bit into a bar of chocolate.
"If I can make you disappear from Mother Russia," Vadim had replied grimly, "I will really be one."
They had pronounced their adieus then and there. Vadim had decided that they would attract less attention if they turned up at the station in the buses with all the other Armenians leaving that day. Aida had hugged her ex-husband to her, so, "I am only good at arrivals," she had said. "I cannot bear the idea that we might not meet again." Vadim had thought she would, at long last, burst into tears. The possibility had unnerved him. He had never seen her weep, and was not eager to cross that threshold at this late date. "What," he had demanded to head off the tears, "is the definition of a Soviet string quartet?" Aida had shaken her head. "A Soviet orchestra that has come back from a tour of America the Beautiful. Ha!" The railroad station had been teeming with Armenians raging at being sent back, and frantic not to miss the train. People seemed to scurry off in all directions. The station, the waiting rooms, the quays, the corridors of railway carriages were littered with chicken bones sucked clean and crusts of bread, and newspapers that had once enveloped sandwiches, and empty bottles and abandoned shoes and filthy blankets that had been folded and used as cots. The Armenians carrying bulky radios, ironing boards, television sets, whatever they had managed to barter or buy in the relatively better-stocked stores of Moscow, had crowded past the single control point at the head of the quay. Ben and Manny, wearing eyeglasses and sporting four-day beards, had waved travel documents in the faces of the harried frontier policemen as they flowed with a river of humanity, heading for the train. Aida, draped in her khaki army blanket, and Sava, tagging after a family with seven children, had slipped past the cordon without any problem. Once the train was underway, the Armenians gradually settled down. The younger ones, camping in the corridors, broke out bottles of slivovitz and harmonicas and began singing folk songs. As a matter of professional prudence, Manny insisted they split up. Ben and Aida found places in one compartment, Manny and the boy in another. The Armenians, with whom Aida and Ben shared the compartment, droned on about the pogroms they had fled from, and the possessions they had left behind, and the uncertainty of what lay ahead. After a time, they too grew silent. The father, an elf-like man with a pockmarked face, glanced briefly at the couple sharing the compartment with his family, then, after trying unsuccessfully to start a conversation with Aida, produced a crossword puzzle, and adjusting his spectacles, began filling in the blanks. The women brought out knitting. One of the children produced a deck of cards and challenged his brother to a game of Melnitsa, a two-handed card game similar to Bluff. Slapping the cards on the floor between them, they played until both boys, their shoulders drooping with fatigue, collapsed into a fitful sleep on the blankets piled on the floor. From time to time, two young soldiers wearing insignias of a KGB border police unit could be seen stepping over the limbs of the Armenians sprawled in the corridor as they made their way from one end of the train to the other. Three times a day, the train was shunted onto a remote siding to change crews, take on water, and flush out the toilets. The Armenians, defying the shouts from the guards, took advantage of the stops to pour from the train and stretch their legs, pick wildflowers or wade in nearby streams until the screech of the whistle announced that it was time to move on. During one such stop, Manny and Sava stumbled down a steep embankment to the edge of a stream. Manny removed his jacket and rolled up his sleeve and splashed water over the seven-day gray stubble on his face. Pulling off his shoes and socks, he installed himself on the stump of a tree and dangled his feet in the still icy water. Sava waved to Ben and Aida, who were sitting in the shade of a walnut tree at the top of the embankment, then turned back to Manny. "Why is it I'm not supposed to talk to you when other people are around?" he asked. "I'm embarrassed at how badly I speak Russian," Manny answered. "That's not the reason," Sava said. "The reason is you don't want people to know you're not Russian." When Manny made no comment, the boy added, "You do make a lot of errors in Russian. You use the wrong declensions all the time." "Look, sonny, I agree my Russian needs work, but it's better than your English."
"I don't speak English," Sava said. "I don't speak American either."
He fell silent for a while, then tugged at Manny's shirt to get his attention.
I had trouble falling asleep last night.
Try counting sheep.
Counting what sheep?
You imagine a field full of sheep, and then you count them.
What good does that do?
It bores you to sleep. I'm bored without counting sheep. How much longer before we get to Rostov?
Depends. On what?
On how much time the train rolls, as opposed to how much time it spends on sidings. Manny noticed the anxiety on the boy's face and relented.
A day and a half, maybe. 2 days at the most. What do we do when we get to Rostov?
You ask a lot of questions for a kid. You don't answer many of them for an adult.
Manny snickered.
Sava scratched a circle in the earth with the tip of a twig.
What kind of a name is Manny?
It's short for Emmanuel. It's biblical.
Why would parents give someone a name from the Bible?
Jesus, when do you turn off? They were religious is why.
In one of my textbooks, it says that religion is the opiate of the people.
What's an opiate?
Something that puts you to sleep.
Is counting sheep an opiate?
You could say that.
Sava wandered off a few paces and started to fling pebbles into the stream.
I have a knife, he called. It has a magnifying glass in it. Vadim gave it to me for my name day.
You don't say. Sava came back and pulled the Swiss Army knife from his pocket. Manny took it and opened a blade. At least it's not rusty, he remarked.
It can't rust. It's stainless steel.
Manny glanced up at the embankment at Ben. In the shade of the walnut tree, he was deep in conversation with Aida. Her hands fluttered as if she were batting away his arguments.
Under the stainless skin, everything rusts, Manny muttered in English.
He switched back to Russian and told the boy, I draw the line at rusty blades. They can infect you with tetanus. He smiled faintly at the memory of the rusty blade clattering to the floor in the Moscow garage.
What's tetanus?
It's a disease that gives you lockjaw. Manny demonstrated.
The jaw lock. You can't talk.
There are injections for things like that.
I'm afraid of injections, Manny said.
Before I took pills, I used to get injections. It's true they hurt, but you get used to them.
Manny glanced at Sava. I like your style, kid. On the hill above them, the train's whistle shrieked. Startled, Manny yanked his feet out of the stream. Come on, kid, and remember not to talk to me in front of other people. That way they won't suspect I'm not Russian.
At dawn the morning after they had passed through Voronezh, Manny came awake with a start. Everyone else in the compartment was fast asleep. At first, he could not figure out what had aroused him. Then it hit him. It was the lack of motion. He parted the soiled window curtain with a fingertip and looked out. The train had come to a stop in a deserted country station. A dark-skinned peasant woman was on her hands and knees scrubbing the tiles in the tiny waiting room. Pressing his face to the window, Manny could make out the station master swinging a red lantern back and forth. The train jerked forward, then stopped, then jerked forward again, and began picking up speed. As it pulled out of the station, Manny saw an empty truck parked along the side of the station master's house. Feeling vaguely apprehensive, he sank back onto the wooden bench next to Sava. Manny had difficulty dozing off. Staring at the window curtain swaying gently back and forth, he had the uneasy feeling that he was overlooking something. Then, suddenly, it came to him. Of course, the truck parked next to the station master's house was an army truck, and it was empty. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.